We're in Genesis 42 now, not long left in the book of Genesis. And we went through Genesis chapter 41 in two sections, if you remember. And the more recent, sermon, the last one, was looking at the pictures of the end times there. And just remind you where we were, though, in the story of Joseph, where he got pulled out of prison, if you remember, to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. After, you know, the butler kind of finally remembered him a couple of years later. And he interpreted these two similar dreams, explaining that there was going to be a seven-year period of plenty, followed by a seven-year period of famine. And then, if you remember, after he interpreted, he then counseled Pharaoh to get someone to stockpile food for the 7 years of famine during the 7 years of plenty. And Pharaoh made him that man. A second in command to Pharaoh, gave him a wife. He had two sons during the time of plenty as well, during that first 7 years. And then it was time for the famine. So that's kind of where we finished up. Verse 53, back in Genesis 41, said, "And the 7 years of plenteousness that was in the land of Egypt were ended, and the 7 years of dearth began to come, according as Joseph had said. And a dearth was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said unto all the Egyptians, Go unto Joseph, what he saith to you do. And the famine was over all the face of the earth. And Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold unto the Egyptians. And the famine waxed sore in the land of Egypt. And all countries came into Egypt to Joseph for to buy corn, because that the famine was so sore in all lands." Then we go into Genesis chapter 42 now in verse 1. And it says, "Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, Why do ye look one upon another?" I'm going to pray and then we're going to get going with Genesis 42. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for this chapter of the Bible, Lord, and the talking points we can get out of it, Lord. Please help me to preach those just clearly and boldly and in a way that people will be edified, Lord, and will grow just in their faith and in the things that you want them to learn about today, Lord. Please help everyone to have attentive ears for all these things to be done in Jesus Christ's holy name. Amen. Okay, so verse 1 said, "Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, Why do ye look one upon another?" So he's basically saying, why are you hanging around? Yeah, why aren't you being proactive, is really what he's saying. And I want to look at this verse, you know, just that point, and just briefly now at the beginning of this sermon, because it is a good reminder for us when we need something, isn't it? Why do we look one upon another? He's basically saying, stop hanging around, stop just loitering, stop just kind of waiting for things to happen, stop just kind of sitting there and staring and thinking, well, when's God going to bless me? He's saying, like, just get up and get busy, right? He's saying, why do you look one upon another? And then he goes on to say, there's corn in Egypt, get you down thither. So he's going, look, there's somewhere to go, there's a solution to our problem, why aren't you doing it? And that for me is a good reminder. For example, when someone needs a job, that's a good reminder, isn't it? When you need a job, when you know, whether you're in a job or you don't like your job, or whether you don't have a job or you need a job, a good reminder is just don't look upon someone else, don't look upon another, and get you down thither and get what you need, right? Get up and get a job. And a great advice, I think I heard it preached a while back, was that if you don't have work, and many people, you know, for different reasons don't have work, is that you should be spending the time that you would be working looking for work. So instead of looking upon one another, instead of kind of sitting there just going, well, you know, God, please bless me, just hope things work out, it's like, well, put that time in, because you probably have, if the average here is a 40-hour a week job, you probably have 40 hours spare to look for work. And look for work. And you go, well, how do you spend 40 hours looking for work? Well, if you've exhausted all avenues, you can spend the rest of that 40 hours a week learning stuff, improving your CV, you know, just doing things which are going to help you, like working out, learning interview skills, learning all this different sort of stuff, instead of just kind of waiting around, right? Because the problem is with waiting around is the more you start to do it, the more you get used to waiting around. And the more you do get used to hanging around and waiting for something else to solve it, and it's not just in you know, when it comes to looking for a job, it's in all areas, isn't it? The more, if you've ever had periods of unemployment or periods, maybe even if you look back to when you're younger, holiday time, you know, from school, college, whatever it is, there's a lot of wasted hours. You look back and think like, what even happened? What did I do? And then when you're busy, there's not enough time in the day, is there? But when you're not, it's like just time just goes, doesn't it? Because everything just takes that little bit longer. But that's why I think we've got to not look upon one another, not just kind of hang around and not just think, oh, well, what, something's going to work out, and just put the time in, put the effort in. Treat it like you're at work. Set your alarm like, oh, get up, right? Get up, get busy, because you start sleeping in, it gets later and later. The night's gone longer. And let's be honest, people aren't usually doing stuff towards getting a job at midnight. But they can't sleep because they're getting up later. So then they're just kind of just hanging around. And then obviously you got the issue where you might be end up walking on the king's rooftop or something and wandering around. And next thing you know, there's sin coming into your life, things like that. But it's not just that. Another thing, another one for that would be a church life. How many people around this world in different nations are looking one upon another? Basically, they're not getting up and doing anything and just going, oh, if only there was a church in my town. Oh, if only there was a church. And don't get me wrong, some people are well-meaning. They send me an email sometimes going, do I know if there's a church in wherever in this country? A lot of the time it'll be. And it's like, look, I you know, the reality of it is I have no more ability than they do to look for a church. Now, they might be asking, do I think that there's a legitimate church? And I can't really confidently recommend a church in this nation, sadly. And you go, that's a bit weird. And look, the reality of it is, because I looked for church for a long time, and every one I ended up thinking, well, I think this is doable, ended up being bad. I can't, but what I always say to people is, by all means, still look. However, you know what? How about you come and visit a proper church? How about you try and find some people and get out there and get soul winning and start doing stuff for God? Because so many people, they're just kind of waiting and waiting and waiting, and then they wait their whole lives away. And it's like, oh, just one day God might bless us with a church in wherever, yet you could have literally just got in a car, got on a train for a few hours and gone to a proper church. And pretty much in most places in this nation, it's not the worst journey, you know? And there are people that do that weekly. There are people in this church that do long journeys. There are people all over the world that do weekly long journeys. And you show me in the Bible where it says you need to have a church within 5 minutes of your house. Instead of looking upon one another, we should be getting us down thither, not just with the church. And like I said, if you don't have one, you don't have one in your nation, get soul winning, get doing stuff. And you're not, you don't automatically just deserve a church in your nation, anyone. And by the way, everyone here lives in England, okay? But if you're watching online, if you ever watch this in the future, if you ever talk to people and they're going like, oh, if only we had a church in wherever, it's like, get busy then. Get busy, get working, get serving, do stuff, and you never know, God might bless you with a church. And in the meantime, try and visit churches. You go, well, that's a bit hard. Well, you know what? There's a lot of time and effort that goes into this church, isn't there? For many members of our church. And without, you know, that time could have been spent doing extra work and earning money and saving money to be able to visit a church if they didn't have one. That time could have been spent solving other things. There's a lot of time, isn't there? You know, instead of just looking around going, well, one day it will happen. What about another one? People go, well, you know, I just so want to get people saved. Oh, I'm not getting people saved when I turn up, you know, once a month to church and go out soul winning or something. And it's like, well, stop looking at each other and get out and get soul winning, right? And the more you soul win, the more you soul win, the more you soul win, the more chance you're going to get someone saved. And then that also applies to when we're out there trying to get our family members saved, trying to get our friends saved. It's like, don't stop looking at each other. Ask them, do they want to hear the gospel? Well, you know, God, I'm just praying for that opportunity when I'm going to be able to approach whoever with the gospel. It's like, ring them up and go, would you like to know how to get saved? I mean, that's a pretty good opportunity, isn't it? Stop looking upon each other. Ring them up, ring up your family member and say, you know, I've just been wondering, would you like to know how you can be sure you're going to heaven? That's a pretty good opportunity. Maybe do it at a time when they're not going to be busy. Pretty simple, right? Problem solved. Another one is for people maybe, and again, like, and this, you know, when I preach this stuff, because some singles aren't looking for this. So just because you're single, it doesn't mean that you must be looking for a wife. So I want to be careful to say that, because look, some people have a gift to not have to. Some people aren't in a position in life where they feel like they want a wife. But if people that do want a wife, and I'm talking especially with the men, because men, I think, in general, have to be a bit more proactive with that sort of thing. It's like, get up and look for a wife. You go, well, what do you mean? Where'd you look? Well, like, go to missions trips, visit churches, get out there, get soul winning, meet people, get people saved, meet members of the opposite sex, get them saved and start to get to know them and disciple them and stuff like that. Just get busy, right? Get busy for God, get busy doing stuff. And, you know, instead of looking one upon another, instead of looking one upon another in church going, one day the woman of my dream is going to walk in the church. It's going to happen. You know, and we just, you know, that's, it's like, get busy instead, you know. He said, behold, I've heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get ye down thither and buy for us from thence. And the point here is that Jacob is having to say to his sons, get proactive, get busy, get doing something. They're in a famine and they're just sitting around. And there's corn in Egypt. And if he heard there's corn in Egypt, I'm sure they knew there was corn in Egypt. Now, we don't have to turn there because we've been going through Proverbs, but Proverbs 13:4 said, the soul of the sluggard desireth and hath nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made fat. And that's a great thing to think about, yeah? The sluggard desires, and whatever area it is. They're just like, you know, for example, like his sons here, just like, oh, if only we had some food. Because they're sluggards. But the soul of the diligent shall be made fat. If you put the effort into whatever area it is, you will get the rewards. You will reap what you put in. Because whatsoever a man soweth, actually also reap. And that applies to all areas of life, really, doesn't it? Well, verse 2, it said, and he said, behold, I've heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get ye down thither and buy for us from thence that we may live and not die. So he's saying, if you want us to survive, you need to be proactive. Go and buy food in Egypt. And Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt. But Benjamin, Joseph's brother, Jacob, sent not with his brethren, for he said, lest peradventure mischief befall him. Now, if you remember, Benjamin was born in between Bethel and Ephrath, which is Bethlehem, when they returned from Padan Aram. But we don't really know when, and it's not clear how what the kind of time periods are there. Now, he's definitely quite a bit younger, although how much younger, we don't know. But it does kind of seem like potentially the old favouritism issue again here. It didn't say he sent him not because he was just a kid. It didn't say he sent him not because he was just a teen and a youth. He sent him not for he said, lest peradventure mischief befall him. And it is kind of like, you know, this seems to be a continuous issue with Jacob, doesn't it? And obviously he came from a background of that as well, if you remember, you know, with himself and Esau, and there's a favouritism with his mother preferring him, his father preferring Esau, because he cook some good meat, you know, and they didn't really have much of a strong reason for the favoritism either. And it's just a good reminder again that you just see these things repeating, don't you? And in fact, and he didn't necessarily know that unless he kind of smelt a rat, but it did kind of end up with his son Joseph ending up being sold into slavery, although as far as he's concerned, he's died. But it was again part of the reason, because of the favoritism and the envy towards him. And it is just a good reminder, isn't it, that look, a lot of this stuff just repeats and repeats. And you can stop that as parents, can't you? You can stop that chain. Just because we were raised a certain way, and none of us have perfect parents here. There's not a perfect parent. None of us are perfect parents. Because we were raised a certain way doesn't mean we have to continue that on with our line and our kids. And we don't have to repeat the errors and the mistakes of our parents. But you have to recognise it, and you have to ask for help with that. Because whether it's favouritism or some other issue, some other problem, some other thing, it can ruin kids, can't it? It can ruin families. And we've already seen some of the results of the favouritism with what happened with Joseph. But anyway, he doesn't send him. And then verse 5, it says, and the sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. And Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, whence come ye? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. So Joseph doesn't want to reveal who he is. And I don't think roughly here is putting on a Mockney accent, by the way, in case you're going, oh, he's tried to, like, you know, kind of roughen up a little bit with the way he talks. Verse 23 says, and they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter. So it's not that he's like, right, I'm going to speak a real kind of, you know, like gutter Egyptian or wherever it is here. It's that he's speaking rudely, okay? He's speaking rudely, speaking roughly to them. And understandably, really, okay? Because he sees them and I mean, you can't really argue with Joseph here. They kidnapped him, were going to kill him, and instead chose to sell him into slavery. And these are his brothers, who he grew up with. 17 years of his life with these guys, and they were planning to kill him for no other reason other than envy. And then not only that, then they just cast him in a pit to let him die in the pit, and then thought, actually, we can make a few quid out of this as well. Let's just sell him into slavery, and that's the end of Joseph. I mean, you can understand him speaking roughly to them. But look how the tables are turned here. It says in verse 6, and Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, whence come ye? And they said, from the land of Canaan, to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew not him. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, ye are spies, to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. Now go back to chapter 37 to remind you of the dreams that Joseph dreamed. We'll just have a quick look at those. Chapter 37 and from verse 5. Chapter 37, 5 reads, and Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf. Now, that's just happened in verse 6, by the way, of chapter 42, where it said, and they bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. So they're making obeisance. And basically, that's like they're obeying in a way, you know, they're in subjection to him. It's not that they're worshipping him, just to make that clear. But verse 8 says, and his brethren said to him, shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. Verse 9 says, and he dreamed yet another dream and told it his brethren, and said, behold, I've dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. So for the literal fulfillment of that, Joseph is probably now aware that his father is to come to Egypt too, I'd imagine, because he's remembering the dreams plural. He's probably thinking, okay, so I can see this all playing out now. And it said in verse 9, Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them and said unto them, ye are spies to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. So he's accusing them of coming to see weakness, as opposed to potentially invade. You know, maybe he's suggesting that they're from another land and maybe they're looking to see a way to invade the land of Egypt during this time of famine. And they said unto him, nay, my lord, but to buy food are thy servants come. We are all one man's sons. We are true men. Thy servants are no spies. And he said unto them, nay, but to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. And they said, thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not, meaning that one has died. And as far as they're concerned, Joseph is likely dead, or at least they've just kind of stuck to that story that they've been playing for a long time now. And they assume he probably is by now. And Joseph said unto them, that is it that I spake unto you, saying, ye are spies. Hereby ye shall be proved. By the life of Pharaoh, ye shall not go forth hence, except your youngest brother came hither and thither. And he's basically saying, as Pharaoh is alive, he's not saying, you know, unless Pharaoh dies, just saying, as, you know, Pharaoh is alive and kicking, you ain't going nowhere. Send one of you and let him fetch your brother, and ye shall be kept in prison, that your words may be proved, whether there be any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely ye are spies. And he put them all together into ward 3 days. Now, as much as Joseph wants to get everyone to Egypt, okay, knowing that there are 7 years of famine, this definitely feels like some revenge, doesn't it? I mean, he didn't have to incarcerate them. He didn't have to tell them that they're spies. I mean, he could have just gone, da-da, you know, it's me. Get Benjamin, get him up here. I'm going to feed you guys up, not to worry, you know, I've forgiven you, blah, blah, blah. But he doesn't, okay? And he starts, you know, he starts doing some funny stuff, doesn't he? Now, did he need to imprison them? And it does seem like he then changes his mind after a few days. And, you know, you could look at this, and sometimes people look at this and be like, ah, oh, Joseph, you know, kind of almost borderline walking on water. This is all just, you know, amazing. And he's just kind of coming up with some interesting ways of doing this and that. But Joseph is just, he's a man of God, but he's also a normal guy. He's a normal guy that was about to be murdered by his brothers and sold into slavery. And I tell you what, I'd like to see one person here who that happened to, who would then, when he comes across them years later, just go, oh, I've just got all this mercy on you guys. That's just not normal. But that is the sort of image we're given of how a Christian should be. A Christian should just, you know, should just forgive anything and everything else. Well, at this point, firstly, they're not seeking forgiveness, as far as he's aware at this point. And B, he's just a normal guy. And as much as, look, you know, holding on to grudges and things like that doesn't really bless you and doesn't really help you, and it oftentimes it's going to make you feel worse. We are still human, aren't we? And we are still just people, and that would be a hard thing to deal with, wouldn't it? Especially when you've got the power that Joseph's got there. I mean, you'd at least probably use a little bit of it. You know, you'd be like, well, a little bit of imprisoning and a few days wind him up a little bit, you know, and then we see some more stuff. He's like, he starts playing games with them, really, doesn't he? It says in verse 18, and Joseph said unto them the third day, this do and live, for I fear God. If ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye carry corn for the family of your houses, but bring your youngest brother unto me. So shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die. And they did so. So he locks them up for 3 days, okay? And then says, because he fears God, he's going to let them go except for one of them. So he's kind of saying, well, actually, you know, maybe he's saying, well, you know, you need to go and bring food back for everyone else. Maybe one of them going wouldn't be enough. Verse 21, they said one to another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us. We were not here. Therefore is this distress come upon us. Now, what's interesting is that they're talking about an event which is by now over 20 years later. This is 20 years down the line. If you remember, Joseph was 17 when it happened in Genesis 41, 46. When it happened. And then in Genesis 41, 46, it says, and Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. So we're now well into the famine, over 7 years later. So this is beyond 20 years from when this event happened. And my point is that sometimes, you know, these guys here, look, they're pretty bad guys, but, you know, they are a Peter. At least they're acknowledging God in all of this. And it can take a while for an old grievous sin to come back and bite you, can't it? It really can. And there are sometimes, you know, there are results of sins that you've chosen to commit that maybe will come and get you in many years to come. And it's just the way it is. And here that seems to be what's happening, really, because they're not going, yeah, but what about, you know, when this happened or when that happened? It seems like this is now where they're kind of reaping what they sowed 20 years ago. That's a long time later, isn't it? It said in verse 22, it says, Reuben answered them, saying, Spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and you would not hear. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required. Now, the more glimpses that we see of Reuben, the worse he seems to get. Really. I mean, in Genesis 37, if you remember when we went through that, I pointed out that Reuben, the whole kind of Reuben was the best of a bad bunch reading of this could be pretty wrong, with the opposite being true. Go back to Genesis 37 and to see what really happened. You'll turn to Genesis 37. Genesis 49 and verse 4. Jacob he's given these prophecies for them. He's talking about each of them, and he refers to Reuben as unstable as water. Thou shalt not excel because thou wentest up to thy father's bed. Thou defiledst thou it. He went up to my couch. Now, like I said, when we went through Genesis 37, unstable as water isn't like a little bit here and there. He's a bit stable, sometimes he's a bit unstable. No, that's just completely unstable. There is no stability in water. You walk on water and you're going to sink unless you're the Lord Jesus Christ, or you get an extra lucky 10 seconds, Peter or something, you know, until your faith comes, right? Okay, so water isn't stable. In Genesis 37, Joseph has been sent to check on his brothers, and it says this in verse 18. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. So it's looking good at this point, is he? You're like, oh, yay, Reuben, the hero. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. So why did Reuben tell them to cast him into a pit? They seem to be happy to listen to him, don't they? They do as he says. He's the eldest. He tells them what to do. They do it. Couldn't he have just stopped it altogether? Couldn't he have just said, don't kill him. Don't kill him. Let's let him go. Couldn't he have gone, Joseph, run. You know, guys, leave him alone. Just let him do what he wants to do. No, he says, throw him in a pit. Throw him in a pit. Let's keep reading. It says in verse 23, well, in fact, before we do, I'll tell you why. Let me show you why. Because it was so that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. It was so that he could deliver him to his father. It was so that he could get some sort of brownie points, so that he could kind of get back in his father's good books after having done some wickedness before with his stepmother. But we're going to keep reading anyway. Verse 23 says, and it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colours that was on him. And they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread. And they lifted up their eyes and looked. And behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. Then there passed by Midianites merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. So he must have been feeling bad for Joseph, you'd think, right? You're like, oh, the poor, you know, he's like, he just really wanted to deliver him. He rips his clothes, you know, in stress or anguish. Verse 30, and he returned unto his brethren and said, the child is not, and I, whither shall I go? I mean, what on earth? The child is not, or where am I going to go? He's worried about himself and where he's going to go, because his plan was to basically bring him back to his father and to basically bring him as some sort of peace offering, some sort of way of getting back into favor with his father, because he committed adultery with his stepmother, Bilhah. And just to make it clear, that's disgusting, isn't it? I mean, how wicked is that with your stepmother? I mean, I remember talking about this with Brother Hooner after we talked about that with Reuben, and just, I mean, that's bizarre. I remember saying, well, I suppose you do, because we were talking about the possibility of him just being a full reprobate. And I remember saying, well, I suppose you do get these sorts of people, and like Jeremy Springer and so, I was kind of thinking, you do get these weird situations. But then the more you start looking at Reuben, you're thinking, actually, like, I mean, that's absolutely vile, isn't it? His father's wife. I mean, and I know you get some freaky things go on in the world, but I mean, that's pretty messed up, isn't it? Pretty messed up. So I think that he's upset. He's going, whither shall I go? Because he couldn't now use rescuing Joseph to gain favor from his father. That's what his goal was, I believe. That's why he's saying cast him into a pit and not just like let him go. And then that would have been that, but instead he could rescue him. And what's he going to do? Take him out of the pit, rescue him, and go, look, I've rescued him from all the others. Aren't I a good one? And then the rest of them can kind of be cast off, and he can be, maybe even, he's thinking about getting an even greater than the double portion of the birthright, and he can end up with the rest of them struck off and get an even better portion of the inheritance, basically. But regardless, it says in verse 31, they took Joseph's coat, and killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colours, and they brought it to their father and said, "This have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no." And he knew it and said, "It is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. And notice this in verse 35, "and all his sons." Not some of his sons, not most of his sons, all his sons, that includes Reuben, and all his daughters. So it wasn't just the one, wasn't just Dinah, there were other daughters as well, but and all his sons and all his daughters, that could maybe include granddaughters, it could include maybe even daughter-in-laws, but regardless, all his sons, so that's Reuben as well, and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and he said, "For I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. So Reuben and the rest of them pretended that their brother had been killed by an animal and then watched their father mourn for him. I mean, that's pretty wicked as well. And again, this guy that was, he was going to deliver them, but now he's playing this kind of dipping the coat in blood and he's been killed. He knew that he'd been, you know, that he'd been sold out of the pit. He's not like, oh man, he must have just died in the pit and disappeared. He's obviously aware of what's happened, but he's playing the whole faking that he was killed because they were all party, at least in one way, to it, because he just wanted to be the one that rescued him. But really, he said, throw him in a pit. Okay? They're now watching their father mourn, who won't be comforted. He said he refused to be comforted. I mean, that's pretty sick as well, isn't it? And watching that, knowing that, in fact, maybe we could go and find him. He's been sold into slavery, Dad. You know, they were on their way down to Egypt. Maybe we could go down and try and find who these merchantmen were. We know what they look like. We sold him to him, you know, etc. No, they're just going to watch their father mourn for him and pretend that he's dead, having dipped his coat in blood. And the Midianites sold him into Egypt under Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. And they could have found that out as well had they found him. So back in chapter 42, where it says in verse 21, "And they said one to another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear, therefore is this distress come upon us." They seem to be showing some remorse now, don't they? That for me looks like some remorse. Thinking about the situation they're now in and accepting the wrong that they did. Sometimes it takes that for us. And I hope no one will ever do anything like this. But sometimes, you know, when you sin, when you do something bad, sometimes it takes you feeling like you're being chastised by God to think, yeah, actually, that was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have made that decision. I shouldn't have behaved that way. I shouldn't have done this. I shouldn't have said that, whatever it is. So they're all showing remorse. They're accepting their wrong, apart from, guess who? Reuben. Verse 22, "Reuben answered them, saying, Spake I not unto you, saying, Do not sin against this child? And you would not hear. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required. But Reuben said to throw him in a pit. Instead of shedding his blood," he didn't say don't sin against the child, he said throw him in a pit. He was party to the whole blood on the coat thing. He was a part of it. He was comforting his father as well and convincing his father that Joseph had been killed. And he's saying that he reckons he said he told him not to sin against the child. And this is another trait of wicked people. Okay, this is another trait of wicked people. They always have an excuse. It's always someone else's fault. They're never to blame. It's always someone else. It's never their fault. They always, it's because of this, because of that, because of their past, because of their this, because they never just go, yeah, okay, I'm to blame. Proverbs 15:10, you have to turn there because we looked at it on Sunday, says, "Correction is grievous unto him that forsaketh the way, and he that hateth reproof shall die." Correction's grievous to them. They just can't accept fault. They hate reproof and they shall die because they're twice dead. What happens with these people, I've noticed, is because they can never be wrong, because they can never accept fault, even when they're bang to rights, even when they're just clear as day, they've been exposed before whoever, exposed in front of many, then the narrative quickly changes to absolve them of any blame. And then it's always someone else's fault. It's always someone else's fault why this happened. It was due to that person, due to this person, due to their background, due to their this, due. It's always someone else's fault. They could do the fake. There's fake repentance. We've seen that with people before, where they pretend they fake the repentance. But then soon after, it was someone else's fault. It was enough. It was this. It was them. It was that. They just can't accept fault. The rest of them are. The rest of them are going, we're guilty for this. But not Reuben. Reuben, nah, it wasn't. There's nothing to do with me. I told you not to sin against him. It's a lie. And he's convinced himself probably of that. He's telling the lie to nine other guys who were there and know full well he said, throw him in a pit. It's no stopping. These people just lie through their teeth. I'm convinced by what Reuben is. You're always a victim. It's not their fault. They speak lies in hypocrisy and then they project it onto others. I mean, what a hypocritical lie that is. You threw him in a pit. Now you're going, well, it's your fault. And what does he do? He projects that onto the rest of them. And that's what these people do. Now, like I said, the rest of them seem to be finally accepting what they did. It says in verse 21, they said one to another, we are verily guilty concerning our brethren that we saw the anguish of his soul. Anguish is extreme pain, either of body or mind. And here, obviously, it's mind, because it says when he besought us. So he's pleading with them. And we would not hear, therefore, as this distress come upon us. So they seem to be accepting it. I mean, that must have been a horrendous situation. You got this 17-year-old kid. He's a kid. He's 17, in anguish, pleading with them, beseeching them, and they wouldn't hear. And by the way, that's the power of envy, isn't it? Think like how eaten up with envy must they have been to be able to treat this kid like that. And you can kind of forgive him for playing games with them now, can't you? Now when you look at that and think about that, you go, yeah, I get it, Joseph. Yeah, bang them up for a few days, you know, send them off and bring them back and, you know, and mess around with them a little bit and put their money back in their bags and then, you know, make them scared and everything else. You can understand it, right? Verse 23, it says, and they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter. And he turned himself about from them and wept and returned to them again and communed with them and took from them Simeon and bound him before their eyes. So I'm sure that he's still affected by what happened. And understandable, like I said. And I think he's probably got some post-traumatic stress from this. I don't think he's looking at them going, oh, I just love my brother so much. I don't think it's tears of love. I think he's listening to them talking about that event and the anguish of his soul, and he's turning around and weeping about it. And you can understand that, right? I mean, the kid, he was about to be murdered. He then got thrown in a pit by his own brothers and then he got sold into slavery. And can you imagine the fear? Can you imagine what a kid must have gone through with that? And that, you know, as we know, this is the word of God. This 100% happened to this poor kid. So it says he bound him before their eyes. He's talking about Simeon. So Simeon definitely got the short straw here. I don't know how he selected Simeon. I don't know if they selected Simeon. But either way, Simeon got chosen here. And then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn and to restore every man's money into his sack and to give them provision for the way. And thus did he unto them. And they laded their asses with the corn and departed thence. And as one of them opened his sack to give his ass provender in the inn, he espied his money, for behold, it was in his sack's mouth. So he's got some corn out to feed his ass. So bear in mind as well, when they're coming for corn, it's not like, oh, they just want to eat it. Because later you see, you know, maybe it's in the next chapter, he's saying, well, go down and bring all these different foods from the land. You're going, well, you had some food. Yeah, but it's for like their animals as well. It's for, you know, all their livestock and for them to not just end up with like nothing. You know, it's for their whole livelihoods as well. And some of it's being used here to feed his ass, and he realizes then that the money that he had paid Joseph was in his sack, okay, the sack that obviously has been loaded up with corn. And he said unto his brethren, my money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack. And their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God hath done unto us? So I suppose that they're worried that they're going to be called thieves. Bear in mind that Simeon's been left there as well. So, you know, it's not kind of a situation where it's like, oh, never mind, we've got away with the money. You know, let's leg it and we won't have to come back there again. It's like they're meant to be coming back to get Simeon. and with Benjamin, and now suddenly they've got all the money as well, and they're just thinking, oh no, what's going to happen now? And they came unto Jacob, their father, unto the land of Canaan, and told him all that befell unto them, saying, the man who is the lord of the land spake roughly to us, and took us for spies of the country. So definitely being rude to them. That's the point. Speaking roughly to us. He's taking them as spies of the country. And we said unto him, we are true men, we are no spies. We be 12 brethren, sons of our father. One is not, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. And the man, the lord of the country, said unto us, hereby shall I know that ye are true men. Leave one of your brethren here with me, and take food for the family of your households, and be gone. And bring your youngest brother unto me, then shall I know that ye are no spies, but that ye are true men. So will I deliver you your brother, and ye shall traffic in the land. So he's talking about trading here with trafficking. And it came to pass, as they emptied their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob their father said unto them, me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me. So he's probably exasperated, okay? He sent them to buy corn, and they've come back one man down. With a demand to bring Benjamin, and it looks like they've stolen the corn to anyone, you know, anyone else, and when they return. Verse 37, it says, Reuben spake unto his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee, deliver him into my hand, I will bring him to thee again. Now, again, if you need any more convincing, what normal man suggests killing his two sons if he fails to do something? Who does that? Who goes, yeah, well, if I, you know, I'm going to make a promise now. Yeah, I've got a promise for you guys. If I don't do this, if I don't return from what is a pretty kind of dodgy situation anyway, just murder my two sons. I mean, what on earth, right? And even if it, and you go, oh, well, maybe it's just an empty offer, you know, he didn't expect Jacob to do that. It's just kind of a turn of phrase. What a bizarre thing to even suggest. What sort of phrase is that? Oh, yeah, just kill my kids. Yeah, guys, well, if we don't get 1,000 salvations this year out of this church, just kill my kids. Slay my kids. Yeah, well, they're not really going to do it, so it's all right, you know. So what on earth, right? Just kill my sons. And continuing with our thoughts about Reuben, I hope it's our thoughts now, and maybe it always has been. It does continue to fit, doesn't it? Because children are just a commodity to these people. They really are. Okay, and I've seen this over the years where, when you've been around these types of people, you know, and whether in church or out of church, they're just a commodity. There's something useful. There's something to pretend with. There's something to maybe give a blag of an image with or something else. The reason is because they lack empathy. They don't have empathy. They don't really care about them. You don't have to turn to 2 Timothy 3:3 and Romans 1:31. Both say that they're without natural affection. They don't have natural affection. They don't really care. Now, they play the game in public sometimes, depending on the angle. So we've had it before where they're just trying to make people think that it's somehow weird and wrong to care about your kids. Like you're a helicopter parent if you care where your kids are in a church full of people you don't really know. I mean, how wicked is that? How wicked is that to try and promote and push that on people that just don't even care where they are. Who cares where they are? Because we're just so free and easy. Oh, yeah. We don't care if our kids are crawling out down a staircase when they can't even walk yet. We don't care if they're being held by who knows who, some single guy in the church, just cuddles my baby while they woo and everything else. I mean, it's completely normal, isn't it? We just give them to people, you know? We just chat and don't even give a damn about them. I don't even know where they are. Pfft, who cares? Because we're not a helicopter parent. Like, that's weird. It's freaky. It's freaky. And I will never stop being astounded when I see that sort of stuff. It's like, it's your kids. The kids that you're meant to love and care about, and you think it's somehow something to gloat about, and you don't even know where they are and what they're doing. What the hell? And it's those sorts of people, like Reuben, who are like, let's kill my kids. Kill my kids if I don't come back. Like, what on earth? That's not natural affection, is it? That's without natural affection. And here's the thing, is he's trying to desperately please his father, but he's revealing his own wickedness. He's trying desperately to please his father. He's trying desperately to prove something, to show something. And he just reveals his own wickedness through it. And this is what often happens, because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. So here's a guy trying to show himself, trying to prove himself, because it's what people do, they try and prove themselves, and then they just show their own wickedness. However, Jacob's thinking, Jacob's not silly, he's just like, no chance, Reuben. He's it's not long after that he's going, he's unstable as water. And he's not going to go and send the youngest with Reuben, who's like, oh yeah, don't worry, if I don't come back, just kill my kids. And he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way under which ye go, then shall ye bring down my grey hairs with sorrow to the grave. So Jacob's basically saying that it would finish him off. He lost his wife in childbirth. His, let's face it, favourite son, Joseph, who's dead as far as he's concerned. He feels like he's lost him as well. His second eldest son, Simeon, is in his opinion probably dead now, or will be at some point. And his weirdo eldest son, Reuben, is offering to take his youngest son back to this seemingly crazy lord of Egypt. I mean, you can understand him going, this ain't happening, Reuben. Thanks, but no thanks. Sorry, Simeon. You had a good inning, son. You managed to kill all that Shechem lot. I mean, let's face it, Simeon's, you know, not exactly got, you know, passed with flying colours in his life, has he? It was, if you remember, it's him with Levi that killed all of that lot in Shechem. And he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he's left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in which you go, then shall ye bring down my grey hairs with sorrow to the grave. He's just saying, it's going to finish me off. And that's normal. That's kind of the normal response, isn't it? And again, there's not much normal about this family, okay? But Jacob's like, look, if I lost another son, that would kill me. That would kill me. Reuben's going, kill my sons if I don't come back. I mean, what a contrast, right? What a contrast in statements here. Now, last week I went through some of the pictures in Genesis 41. And like I said last week, Joseph coming out of prison, having a beard trim and a change of clothing. And for me, also having a change of symbolism, I believe going from a Christ figure to an Antichrist figure. Now, with what seemed to be a new Pharaoh now symbolizing the devil, giving power to the beast. And if you didn't see, if you're unsure about that, just watch last week. And if you don't agree, you don't have to agree. But see last week if you're unsure. I'm not going to go through it all now. But just to make it clear, this is only symbolism, okay? It's symbolism. And a lot of the events obviously aren't identical. So it's like, oh, well, wait a second. But what about this person? You know, what about them going and coming back with money? And how does this fit in? Because it's just symbolism. There are symbols and things which are pictures of things. And I believe we can learn something from that symbolism last week. But I believe that some of those pictures do seem to continue here in this chapter, some of that. With the sons of Jacob representing believers being persecuted in the tribulation. So verse 8 says, and Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew not him. And this represents, for me, before the Antichrist is revealed, deceiving many. Matthew 24:5 says, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. So many will be deceived, and I think if it were possible, even the elect. So I think for us in that time, you know, there'll be a time when we're not sure, and we won't know, and we won't know if that world leader, and we will be unsure until ultimately we'll only know 100% for sure, you know, when that abomination of desolation standeth in the holy place. But even before that, I think many will start to get an idea, but not right at the beginning, not when he rises to power. Verse 9 says, "And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, Ye are spies to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. And they said unto him, Nay, my lord, but to buy food of thy servants come. We are all one man's sons, we are true men, thy servants are no spies. And he said unto them, Nay, but to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. And they said, Thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not. And Joseph said unto them, That is that I spake unto you, saying, Ye are spies. Hereby ye shall be proved. By the life of Pharaoh, ye shall not go forth hence, except your youngest brother come hither. Send one of you, and let him fetch your brother, and ye shall be kept in prison, that your words may be proved, whether there be any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely ye are spies. And he put them all together into ward 3 days. Matthew 24:9 says, Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. I think that's a picture of the persecution of believers, with the sons of Jacob representing the believers and being persecuted, being put in prison, etc. And then it says in verse 18 where you are, And Joseph said unto them, The third day, this do and live, for I fear God. If ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine of your houses, but bring your youngest brother unto me. So shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die. And they did so. He's asking them to deliver their brother to him. And Matthew 24:10 says, And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another, and there'll be people being delivered up, etc. So I think that's what that's about. Picture of there. I think that picture continues, but again, you don't have to agree. That's what I believe. And I think that at least passage of that is just picturing that persecution of believers, and obviously being hunted down, being almost, you know, being encouraged to betray one another, etc. And that's what he's ultimately, it seems like a picture of him doing, saying, bring your brother, basically. And there's other, you know, there's passages like, for example, if they say he is here, go not there, etc. And again, you know, you could add that into that, but I think that's probably a bit that's earlier on when they're trying to gather up. They're trying to basically, there's going to be a persecution of believers, with believers getting hunted down and killed. I think that's what that is a picture of. And that was Genesis chapter 42. And we're going to finish up in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for, the truths we can get out of that. And again, just, you know, to go with our sort of Proverbs study, just the reality of people like Reuben, Lord, and just what a real life example there is there of someone like that, and what we can learn from that, and help us to just be as far away from that sort of person as possible, and in our behaviour as well, help us to just be behave like the sorts of people you want us to, Lord. Please just bless us now as we go into our week, and help us to be proactive, Lord, with everything we want to do in all areas of our lives, not to just sit around looking upon one another, but to get up and go where we need to go to be busy, be proactive in our lives, Lord, and help us to get home safe and sound. Help us to return on Sunday, and for the ladies to have a great day on Saturday. In Jesus' name, pray all this. Amen.